The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
What is the mission imperative that the current authorities allow us to leverage to protect the nation? And if there were a decision that would be made that would be have a different construct than we currently have, how could we maintain that same flexibility? I think that there are things that are under discussion that are different than how we currently do it, that would be workable. General Alexander has shared that. The bottom line, though, is those decisions will be made, and then we will adhere to them faithfully.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, Special Edition, Part 5, the last part, Inside NSA. You already know the drill. Bobby Chesney and I brought a recording device into NSA and walked out with a bunch of podcast interviews. The last one was one I did myself without Bobby, with Fran Fleisch. She's now the acting deputy director of an agency that's under assault and undergoing an unprecedented opening up. She's been at NSA a long time. She came up through the ranks there, entering as a Russian language linguist more than 30 years ago. I talked to her about openness and secrecy, about the agency's culture, and about the disparity between how it sees itself and how many in the public see it. We talked about the leadership transition that is now underway, in which both of the top two leaders are leaving. And we talked about how the agency sees its own role in Congress's deliberations over what authorities it should and should not have. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Inside NSA, Part 5.
So let's start with you and your role here. How does one come to be the executive director and now, I guess, the acting deputy director of NSA? And explain sort of your history and your role here.
Oh, sure. Well, first, thanks for the opportunity to chat with you today. I think that there is no one set way you get to be a senior leader at NSA. My particular path, I started as a Russian linguist in the 1980 and worked in operational areas on the Soviet target for about the first half of my career and diversified and had a number of management and senior staff positions, worked across the community, was elevated to our senior executive service in 2001, and since then have had a series of senior leadership positions. In the case of my selection and where I am today, the position of executive director is something that was reconstituted in the 2010 timeframe at about the same time that the director was promoted to his 4-star and assumed the role of commander, U.S. Cyber Command, in conjunction with his duties as director NSA. I think everyone, both internally and externally, realized that that was going to be those extra responsibilities would be prudent for us to look and see if we could make sure that we had extra strength in the leadership team to be able to ensure continuity and management for NSA. So they reconstituted that position. It's, in shorthand, I would call it the deputy to the deputy of NSA. So to the larger question of my very new role as the acting deputy director, just started that this week, it's really a continuation of what I have been doing over the last 3 years, working in conjunction primarily with Chris Inglis, our deputy director, in the day-to-day running of the agency.
So before I go on, I want to pause over your initial entry to NSA as a linguist. One of the things that I think a lot of people don't understand about
this agency is the sort of analytical culture of a large number of the people. To explain, just at a cultural level, the sort of linguist, analyst, mathematician, engineer, and military hybrid culture of this place, which I've never seen anything remotely like anywhere else. And I'm just interested in your sense, as someone who came in as a linguist, what are the different cultural components that make up this agency?
You know, so that's a great question. I don't think that we're different than many other large organizations that would require a myriad of skill sets to come together and all be pulling in the same direction to be able to accomplish the mission. You talked a little bit about our civilian military components. We also work together with contractors. To the extent that I'll talk about the signals intelligence mission, about which I'm most familiar because where I grew up, that is very important, and culturally we reinforce and make it possible for folks from across all disciplines to understand the processes end to end. And so it's not as if there are discrete elements that work in isolation and don't work together. They admittedly do have, I think, different talent sets, different academic backgrounds, and they play different roles. So it's natural that they would have maybe kind of cultural differences, but there is a lot of crossover, and so I think it's not surprising that you would find that people would start at the agency in one discipline as I did, and over the course of the career here, one of the great things is that you can move into different areas. So, for example, when I do the oath of office and I administer that to our new employees as they're coming on board, regardless of where they're going to be going to and where they've come from, prior military, just out of school, whatever their situation is, I tell them a couple of things. One, I tell them that they're entering part of a larger intelligence community. They happen to be affiliated with NSA, but it will be important over the course of their career that they have an opportunity and they will be expected to work across that. Two, I will tell them that it is that NSA offers them opportunities that they don't even understand yet in terms of the breadth and depth and how much we will endorse and favor people diversifying and trying new things, and that's to our advantage. And third, and most importantly, we actually do the swearing in of our new employees at the our Cryptologic Museum just across the way. It is a great backdrop for the history of our agency, and it's a wonderful time and place to reinforce for them as they take an oath to the Constitution the importance and value that we place on protection of civil liberties and what their responsibilities are as they come into NSA and they are given exceptional authorities to work under.
So one of the things that you've had to try new things that I don't imagine you imagined when you got sworn in yourself is being the deputy to the deputy at a time when an agency that is all about keeping secrets gets really thrust into the public eye in a very negative way, and sort of managing the fallout from that. It's a stupid question to say, did you ever imagine yourself doing this? But what? I won't ask that. But I'm just curious for your sort of thoughts about being in the senior leadership of this organization at a time when the world gets turned upside down.
No one could have imagined that we would be here, and no one would have wanted to have things play out the way they did this summer. But that said, it's really an honor and privilege to be working together with our senior leadership team in support of our workforce in trying to make sure that people who are writing and talking about us have an opportunity to understand the true sense of what we do and how we do it, because I think we do it just right. In terms of as you put it, in an environment where by necessity, because of how we, out of necessity, intelligence is conducted in secret. It is countercultural to be at the place where we are now, where we're out talking so much about secrets. But it's not new news that NSA has tried to offer details to the public about what we do. We've done that in a number of different ways. I mentioned the museum a little bit earlier. We have a lot of outreach into the community. I think especially since 9/11, NSA has been, I think, a little bit more forward-leaning in the press. When I first started in 1980. We were no such agency. Our affiliation was with the Department of Defense. So there are a lot of things that have changed over time. I think the big difference here is now, while we were maybe moving, we were trying to move into a spirit of transparency, for letting the public know what it is we've done, what we do here. The difference is that, the revelation through unauthorized disclosures of secret material now have the discussion be, the discussion is about material that's secret. And so how do you navigate, the reacting to information that shouldn't have been disclosed in the first place? And how do you walk the fine line of making sure that you are addressing it appropriately, but not compounding the problem? I'll be the first to admit, as you noted, this is not something that we do naturally. And so I think we've learned as we've gone. It's not something that we were practiced at, but I think what hopefully you and others who are talking with people from NSA and participating in various forums, especially since June as the unauthorized disclosure started to roll out, our leadership team has made a very calculated effort to lean very far forward in conjunction, of course, with the administration and the intelligence community to make sure that information, that we're as transparent as we can possibly be. I think this conversation today that I'm having with you and that you've had podcast sessions with other members of our senior leadership team is representative of that.
And when you say you've kind of learned as you went, so what are the big things about this project that are different from, you know, that you've had to learn as you went and that you really didn't expect to be dealing with or have to deal with?
Well, I think there are several different dimensions. I mean, truthfully, the position that we're put in terms of responding to stories in the press that are sensational, in some cases sensationalized, incomplete, and without context, I think that puts us at a disadvantage in terms of how we can respond to those if there isn't an opportunity to put all of the facts out there. So I think that's one thing that we've learned. It is a very hard place to be. It's a hard place to be in terms of getting out ahead of the story, so to speak, which might be what people's inclinations would be. So
can I ask you about that? I mean, I have seen a number of incidents where things that have been in the press have been just not merely incomplete, but just wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And the capacity of the agency or the administration to address them directly and correct the errors is limited by the fact that you actually don't want to put out information about the actual activities, or for that matter, information about non-activity that would suggest gaps. Talk about the challenge of correcting wrong information without validating right information.
You know, that's a great point, because I think the backdrop and one of the things that we need to be mindful of is that as information is revealed, in the press, whether it's through an unauthorized disclosure or a conscious decision, by the government to release information, that will tell adversaries, by definition, information about how we do our business, and it puts the nation at risk, truthfully. So we're always balancing that in a calculated way.
So one of the oddities of this whole episode is that it's taken place as a leadership transition was, as best as I can tell, going to happen here anyway. You're suddenly in the middle of this. So give us an overview of the leadership transition that's now already started and that's going to be happening over the next several months.
Sure. General Alexander and Chris Inglis have been long serving as our director and deputy director. In fact, they both have extended the normal tours here in response to calls for them to stay on in their position and because it was the right thing to do. I think it was announced in the fall, a nominal timeline for their transition, so it's not new information today that they were going to be transitioning. I believe General Alexander will probably be moving out of his position in the early spring time frame, and Chris Inglis, our deputy director, has stepped down from the deputy director duties and will officially retire in the early January time frame.
And the Washington Post is reporting today, which I had not seen reported before, that the decision has been made not to separate the NSA directorship from Cyber Command. Does that mean that as a practical matter, we are going to see sort of a transition of NSA more or less as it is today from one leadership team to the next? Or are there potentially still significant structural changes that are being contemplated?
So I'm not aware of any significant structural changes, as you put it. And I had also heard that today the administration had confirmed the decision to sustain the dual hatting of the director NSA and the commander of U.S. Cyber Command. There is an orderly process by which we would do the transition of our leadership in terms of nominations through the executive branch, and in the case of the director slash commander, a Senate confirmation. And so those will all proceed apace.
So let's turn to Snowden. I guess the first question is, how confident are you at this point that we know the scope of the material that he took, and what has happened to that material? And how would you assess in the aggregate the damage of the disclosures that he's made?
I think we have a good sense of the material that he had access to. I think it's much harder to address the disposition of that material in terms of who has what. For the damage, General Alexander is on the record as saying that it is significant damage to the nation, and I would agree with that assessment. I mentioned earlier that the more that is disclosed about our operations and that our adversaries would have an advantage of knowing about, the higher the likelihood that they'll make adjustments. And we're already seeing some indications that they certainly are aware and contemplating adjustments.
So whenever I have a conversation with a real skeptic of, you know, intelligence community activity, I always say something like, you know, people inside say the damage was very significant. And people always roll their eyes and say, you know, the sun still rises in the east and sets in the west. And, you know, show me what has been suffered, that I can see and taste and feel. And I am curious how, other than saying that people have adjusted and that affects operations, what do you say to a skeptic who says, I can't see or hear or taste or feel any of this damage that you're talking about, and I'm skeptical that it's real?
So, you know, NSA has been entrusted with a foreign intelligence mission, and the nation has made a huge investment in our capabilities to be able to conduct that. So over the any impact in terms of revelations of our procedures and methodologies and how we go about our job implicitly will cause us to need to make adjustments, not only in how we conduct our business, but perhaps in how we invest and what we need to do. That will be hard for an outsider to see, and it's probably something that we wouldn't talk about in public. It's hard to prove a negative. And I think that's really kind of what you have asked here. How is it that we can prove that something, you know, bad hasn't happened? It's not an issue that I think that we would be able to talk about in this venue, where I would be able to put forward information that would allow people to understand what the changes are. And I would say, too, that our organization is an evolving organization. And by that, I mean there are constant changes that we need to respond to. Forget the Snowden issue, you know, but there are technological changes and advances, and adversaries have changes in the way that they conduct their business that cause us always to be adjusting. And so it might be transparent to folks because we are always adjusting. But that doesn't mean that it's not impactful, and it's hard to know when you lose a certain capability whether that will be the critical capability on a specific issue.
It seems to me that in that answer lies a lot of the basic tension, where, you know, one side says, I can really, the collection that has been identified and publicized is very tangible to me. That means, you know, my metadata is going into a database. But the positive outcomes of use can be quite opaque and have to rely to a great degree on faith in statements by, you know, people who, run spy agencies for a living, right? and I'm curious how you close that gap in which people either have confidence in statements like the one you just made, to a greater degree than the polls suggest that they currently do, or that they come to understand the, at least at a high level of altitude, the activities of agencies like this one such that they accept more implicitly than they seem to now.
So the building of the trust in terms of people who aren't trusting of us now will take time, certainly, and this coming off of the events of the summer and into the fall will make that harder. I think in our case, I acknowledge that we could do a better job, and we're continuing to really see how we can refine and tell our story about really what is, after all, a very complex business in terms that are more transparent and resonate more in terms of people being able to fully understand all the complexity. So we would follow up on that. I think that there are two other aspects that I would highlight. One, it is for us profoundly important that the part of the discussion about our collection and that people should trust us needs to be based on an acknowledgement and a recognition of all the things that we already do in terms of protecting the material that we process, that we work with, especially vis-a-vis U.S. persons. And so I know publicly we've talked about that quite a bit. I don't feel that we have really had the breakthrough event where people feel heartened by all of that.
Can I stop you on that? Because this, you know, you guys have released an incredible amount of material, and material of a sort that I never would have imagined would ever be released. And it's really dense. It's really legally complicated. We on the Lawfare site have tried to summarize all of it and create, you know, make it more accessible than it natively is. Very few people read it. I don't think there are that many people who are reading the information that gets released, or for that matter, our summaries of it. And I'm wondering if this is an area where transparency has sort of a huge theoretical value, but basically people made up their minds when they read the first few news stories and were either offended or they weren't. And the marginal impact of new releases of information is just, you know, a buckets of water in an ocean.
Yeah, so I would concede that I think you're probably right that the average American is not going to probably sit down and go through all of the documents that have been released. I'd hate to say that there isn't an opportunity to still be able to provide information and inform folks that would help them, you know, form a different opinion if they have a negative opinion or they have, you know, they don't have the information they need to understand it. I think, though, there are many different aspects in terms of the transparency. The release of the documents is one. I think engagements, my observation is that typically when we send some of our senior leaders out to speak in to major forums at law schools or whatever, we often start with an antagonistic or an audience that's skeptical and maybe has already well-formed views. But as they talk through it with folks, I think maybe people are not totally persuaded. In other words, maybe we don't have a total change of heart, but I think at least that there's an acknowledgement of how complex this is and that the steps that we put in place to protect U.S. persons are really quite strong. And I think this is where also I would say, Ben, that it is interesting for us to tell the story. I think it has the potential of being even more impactful if others who are aware of our work can attest to the integrity with which we conduct it, or the impact for the nation, or the potential risk if we were to lose these capabilities. And we have some number of people who have entered into that dialogue. And so I think the more informed discussion is what will be better for everyone.
And do you, I mean, one of the things that I'm very struck by in all of the conversations I've had around this building is you constantly hear a concern right up there when people talk about mission with civil liberties protection, not spying on U.S. persons. And outside this building, people talk about the agency as voraciously gobbling up everything in the world. And people would be very surprised at outside the building, at the degree to which people inside the building have, as part of their kind of internal culture, internalized a lot of civil liberties concerns that are reflected in the law, that are reflected in the agency's public statements. But nobody believes it. And I'm curious what you attribute that disparity to. How does it come to be that there's an agency that pays as much attention as this one does to the parameters of its collection authorities and has as awful a reputation for being a voracious vacuum cleaner as it does? How do you square those two things?
I'm not really going to be the one that's going to be able to square people's perceptions with what goes on here. What I prefer to talk about is, let me turn it around again. What would be for somebody like you from the outside who's been following this, would you have a suggestion about what we could do that would be different and more compelling in terms of telling the story? Because just as you have learned in talking with personnel as you visited the agency and had an opportunity to talk to folks, it is absolutely true in terms of on the very first day when employees entered the agency that they are indoctrinated in terms of their responsibilities in upholding the Constitution. The training and rigor and execution of mission is something that is firmly ingrained here. I'm hoping that as in these kinds of discussions and others, that people will at least pause on that. But if you have suggestions about how we could do that better, I'd be all ears.
So as we look forward, there are a lot of proposals in Congress for significant reforms. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them, some of them anyway, reflect very different visions about what the Constitution and the law should be seen as requiring or should require. I'm curious how much space you think there is for legislative recalibration here, and is this an area where you need all the authority that you currently have, or is this an area where a prudent Congress might draw some of the lines in different places than it has in the past? And how would the agency respond to that?
Certainly. Well, I think that there has been an ongoing discussion, as you know, and you've alluded to. I think people are in the process of looking at that very thoughtfully in the light of the tensions that we've been talking about and that exist. I think that for me, I would personally prefer not to talk about, for example, the merits of any individual legislative option. And instead, what we talk about typically is what is the mission, what are the mission requirements, or what is the mission imperative that the current authorities allow us to leverage to protect the nation. And if there were a decision that would be made that would be have a different construct than we currently have, how could we maintain that same flexibility? I think that there are things that are under discussion that are different than how we currently do it that would be workable. General Alexander has shared that. The bottom line, though, is those decisions will be made, and then we will adhere to them faithfully.
This is an agency that does not set its own, its own legal authorities obviously are set by Congress. But you presumably not without views as to which of the activities that the agency engages in are strictly necessary and mm-hmm. which are discretionary that a reasonable Congress might say, hey, we want to draw the lines in other places. Is the agency's posture in general to advocate for its authorities, or is the agency's authority and posture in general to say, hey, it's up to Congress what we have the authority to do, and we'll salute and try to do the best we can within the parameters of whatever rules get set?
So I think our leadership would absolutely feel the responsibility to convey what the threat is that we see, what the current authorities are that we have that allow us to address that threat, what the capabilities we would need as a nation, and what the risks would be under different scenarios that are under discussion, so that people could make an informed decision.
Thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Ben.
A lot of people deserve mention for helping make this podcast series happen. Thanks to all the officials at NSA who spent time with Bobby and me, and to the officials at NSA, whom I'm not going to name, who worked with us to arrange these conversations. It's not an easy thing being an open, transparent spy agency. They're really working on it. Back home, our friends in the Brookings studio were a big help, as always. The Lawfare podcast is produced in collaboration with the Brookings Institution. Our music, of course, is performed by Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.